You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Mit Wieso Steuer? Bis zum 31. Juli abgeben.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 119, Setting the World Aflame. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking our Patreon supporters. You are the ones carrying this show. I couldn't do it without you. As always, I'd like to invite the rest of you to join us on Patreon. I finished out our last bonus episode with one of my favorite quotations I've ever read on this show, a long passage from The Recollections of Rifleman Harris, a British soldier of the 95th Rifles who I quoted from extensively last episode. There's more detail about the hell of General Moore's retreat, with particular focus on the struggle to maintain discipline, which, in the British Army, was often achieved by liberal use of the whip. If that sounds interesting to you, visit patreon.com/ageofnapoleon. Anyway, we left off last time in the waning days of 1808. The second French invasion of Iberia was well underway. All along the front, Spanish patriot armies had been smashed, and Bonaparte's men were on the advance. The only undefeated coalition field army, a force of about 40,000 mostly British troops, under General Sir John Moore, were in the midst of a difficult retreat into the province of Galicia, the furthest northwestern corner of Spain. The French were in close pursuit. They had been led by the Emperor himself, but he abruptly left mid-campaign. He was needed back in Paris. It was becoming increasingly clear that France's old enemies, the Habsburgs, were mobilizing for war once again. Napoleon needed to respond to this crisis. With Bonaparte gone, the pursuit of Moore was taken over by Marshal Jean de Dieu Soult, the former drill master whose strict but effective methods had helped mold the Grande Armée into one of the greatest fighting forces the world has ever seen. The French came very close to catching Moore. There were skirmishes between the French and British cavalry, and on several occasions, the Allies were forced to deploy a rearguard to fight off the advancing French. In one of these engagements, near the somewhat strangely named town of Cacabelos, an Irish soldier of the British 95th Rifles named Thomas Plunkett made perhaps the most famous single shot of the war, felling General Auguste Colbert from an almost unbelievable range. Sources differ, but it was perhaps as far as 600 meters, or nearly 2,000 feet. To put that in perspective, the effective range of a musket was only about 80 meters, and even the British rifle regiments, armed with state-of-the-art Baker rifles, generally did not engage the enemy from any further than about 200 meters. But Plunkett was well known as one of the best shots in the 95th Rifles, which meant he was probably one of the best marksmen in the whole British Army, perhaps all of Europe. As if to prove the shot was no fluke, Plunkett then reloaded and picked off one of General Colbert's aides, who had gone to help his fallen general. In the early days of the new year, Moore's army began to emerge from the mountains and enter Galicia. Their trial was not yet over, but they had made it through the darkest days, and the end was in sight. On January 11th, the British reached their objective, La Coruña, one of the main port cities in this region, where the army was set to rendezvous with a large Royal Navy squadron for evacuation back to Britain. Apparently, many of the Spanish civilians who turned out to watch their allies enter the city were taken aback by the army's poor condition. The retreat had taken a terrible toll. Around 5,000 men had either been killed by the French or died on the road. Another 3,500 were no longer fit for duty. The survivors looked like scarecrows, ragged, gaunt, and dirty. The people of the city must have wondered how these sorry specimens had ever hoped to stand up to Napoleon. Moore had lost over 20% of his force without fighting a major battle. However, morale was not as bad as you might think. Only a few weeks earlier, the army had seemed to be on the verge of disintegration. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of British troops had dropped out of the ranks to rest, look for food, or go marauding. Several Spanish towns had been sacked by unruly British soldiers. We talked about the riot at Astorga last episode. Only a few days later, similar events occurred at the town of Villafranca, which was practically burned to the ground. But there was a shift in tone as the army emerged from the mountains. Successful rearguard actions against the French helped the troops regain a measure of self-confidence. Stragglers, who had fallen behind or deserted during the march, returned to their units, and Moore was able to link up with reinforcements. Perhaps most importantly, there were huge stocks of supplies waiting for the British. For the first time in nearly a month, the army was eating well. Things were looking up for the British. However, when they arrived at La Coruña, they discovered the navy was late. Only a small fraction of the evacuation squadron had arrived. Moore loaded the sick and wounded onto the few ships in the harbor and began preparing for battle. Meanwhile, Marshal Soult was advancing cautiously. The French had suffered almost as badly as the British. They had maintained their discipline, and generally speaking, it is better to be the pursuing army than the retreating army. However, the pursuers did have one disadvantage that had proved to be important in this campaign. There was no food to be foraged. At every stage of the march, the French had been advancing through land that had already been picked clean by the British. Soult had lost almost as many troops as Moore, and his units were strung out across a huge area. His cavalry and advance guard were right on Moore's heels. But most of his force was at least a few days' march from the front lines. In fact, by this stage, both commanders believed they were outnumbered, and so both proceeded with caution. Moore prepared to fight a defensive battle close to La Coruña, and Soult advanced very slowly. He was determined to attack. Until the British evacuation was complete, they would be vulnerable, with their backs to the sea. Unfortunately for the French, this would be no easy task. The city of La Coruña was nearly an island, connected to the mainland only by a narrow strip of land. The immediate outskirts of the city were dominated by hills and rough highland terrain. And so, Moore was able to arrange his army in a strong defensive line on good high ground, with his flank anchored on the Atlantic Ocean. In a strategic sense, the British army was vulnerable, with its back to the ocean and nowhere to retreat, but it probably did not feel that way within the British lines. In fact, the mood among the Redcoats seems to have changed completely. According to several first-hand accounts, it was as if the horrors and chaos of the past few weeks had been completely forgotten. As bad as the retreat was, a few days of rest and good food had worked wonders. On the French side, morale had never gotten quite as low during the march through the mountains, but on the other hand, they had no depots in Galicia, and they hadn't had much time to rest and regroup. The dynamic had now flipped. It was now the British who enjoyed the edge in morale and energy, and the French who were tired and disgruntled. Neither general would be able to bring his full force to bear. Many of Moore's troops were in no condition to fight, and some had already boarded ships bound for England. Many of Soult's troops were in the same condition, and some of his units were still struggling through the mountains. In total, the British defenders numbered about 16,000, and their French enemies about 15,000. The British had a slight advantage in numbers, and a greater proportion of their force was made up of infantry, which was an advantage in this rough terrain, in which cavalry would be of only limited use. Moore decided to keep his front lines relatively weak. Only about 9,000 troops were manning that ring of hills, directly facing the French. About 40% of his force would be held back in a strong reserve. Once Soult committed to an assault, Moore would use his reserve to counterattack. Soult planned to focus most of his efforts on the British right, the part of the defenses closest to the city of La Coruña. Then, once the infantry made an opening, he would swoop in with his cavalry to seize the ground between the rest of the British force and the city, thus trapping the defenders. As you can probably tell, these were not ideal conditions for the French. Attacking a motivated and well-supplied enemy in a strong defensive position with inferior numbers. However, by January 15th, the rest of the British evacuation squadron had arrived. Soult was out of time. He couldn't wait for reinforcements. If the French didn't attack now, the British would slip away without a fight. With all that said, under the circumstances, Soult's plan was not bad. If the French could create a big enough opening in the British defenses to bring their cavalry into play, the situation would become very dangerous for Moore and his army. Despite the strength of their position, some of Moore's officers actually favored negotiating with Soult. One crack in the line might be enough to destroy the army. Why take the risk? And besides, what would be the first thing the French asked for in a ceasefire? Obviously for the British to leave Galicia, which they were trying to do. It's not often wartime enemies find their interests aligned, so why not take advantage? But Moore shot them down. Like his troops, he was feeling increasingly confident. And besides, he had always seen himself as a man of honor, not the type to run away from a fight. I have to wonder if he wasn't also thinking of his reputation. As I mentioned last episode, the fact that Moore was one of the most famous generals in the British Army, and yet had never won a major battle in independent command, was something of a blemish on an otherwise sterling biography. Not only was Moore determined to fight, he was determined to lead his men from the front. He aimed to finally live up to his reputation. There was skirmishing between the two armies on January 15th. Many British officers believed the day had finally come, and the decisive battle was about to unfold, but Soult was merely testing their position, and the fighting quickly died down. General Moore expected the big attack to come the next morning. He woke up before dawn, mounted his horse, and toured the British positions on the heights one last time, just to make sure everything was in place and the men were ready. But the hours ticked by, and nothing happened. Finally, by around noon, Moore began to doubt Soult would attack. He sent orders back to La Coruña to resume the evacuation, which had been temporarily paused, so the British could focus all their strength on the coming battle. At this point, they were still mostly moving the sick and wounded, along with horses and equipment from the baggage train. But if the French did not attack by 4 in the afternoon, Moore planned to begin evacuating combat-ready troops from his reserve, leaving the men on the heights to hold the line until the last possible moment, then pulling them away under cover of darkness that evening. Assuming Soult was not going to attack, Moore expected to have the whole army at sea by daybreak on the 17th. I have to wonder if part of him wasn't disappointed as he issued these orders. If they were carried out, that great victory to finally solidify his reputation would remain elusive. By about 1:30, units of the reserve had begun to move towards La Coruña in preparation for their evacuation. Up on the heights outside the city, French and British units were still glaring at each other, but neither side had begun firing artillery. The mood was strangely calm. The British were surprised to see a lone figure approaching their lines. Even more surprising, as the figure got closer, it turned out to be two people, a woman carrying a small baby. It was the wife and child of one of the soldiers in the 50th Regiment of Foot. She had fallen sick during the retreat, become separated from the regiment, and fallen into the hands of the French. Marshal Soult had taken a personal interest in her case, ordering his doctors to treat her, and even giving her money. Now healthy again, the French had determined it was safe enough to send her back to her husband and friends, along with a note from Soult explaining the situation. even in this ugly, brutal war, there were moments of humanity. The eerie calm around La Coruña was finally shattered at around 2 in the afternoon. The French artillery opened up all along the line. The British responded in kind, but many of their cannon had already been evacuated, so they got the worst of it. Apparently, the British gunners had been in the middle of boiling potatoes for their lunch. They stuffed the half-cooked spuds into their pockets before running to their cannons. British units that had been marching towards the port for evacuation abruptly turned around and rushed back to their old positions at the double. French skirmishers were already advancing into the valley between the two positions. The Battle of La Coruña had begun. Among the first British casualties was one of the army's highest-ranking officers, Moore's second-in-command, General Sir David Baird, who took a cannonball to the arm. He would survive, but was definitely out of the fight. Almost all the French efforts were focused on the British right flank. They advanced in a large assault column, then split in two as they approached the hills, roughly half driving straight into the British defenses, and half aiming for the extreme right, hoping to turn the flank. They would be received by the 42nd Royal Highland Regiment of Foot, commonly known as the Black Watch, one of the oldest and most famous units in the whole British Army. The Highlanders were lying down just behind the crest of a hill to hide their numbers and position. When the French came within musket range, they stood up, delivered a volley, and charged with the bayonet. The most intense combat took place in and around a small settlement called Elvigna. The main French attack would pass right through the village. It was the key to this whole section of the British line. The main building material in this part of Spain was stone. The buildings and even the fences in the town were sturdy and bulletproof. It was practically a fortress. The French took Elvigna, but the British 50th Regiment of Foot counterattacked and retook most of the village with the bayonet. However, they soon found themselves pinned down by withering enemy fire and running low on ammunition. One officer of the 50th described pulling buttons off of his uniform jacket, loading them into a captured French carbine, and firing them at the enemy. Moore ordered other units to reinforce Elvigna, but their officers took one look at the intense fighting and chose not to obey. Once again, the village fell to the French. Further down the line, the men of the Black Watch had also run out of ammunition, and the regiment began to waver. It was not a rout, at least not yet, but the unsteady Highlanders began to drift backwards. General Moore was nearby, and seeing his fellow Scots faltering, he galloped right into the thick of them, crying out, quote, "My brave 42nd, you still have your bayonets! Think on Scotland!" End quote. Maybe the men really did start considering their national honor, or maybe seeing their general among them raised their spirits. In any case, the Black Watch began moving back towards the enemy. General Moore took off his hat to offer a salute to the advancing Highlanders. One of his aides described what happened next. Quote, "I was pointing out to the general the situation of the battalion, and our horses were touching at the very moment that a cannonball from the enemy's battery carried away his left shoulder and part of the collarbone, leaving the arm hanging by the flesh. The violence of the stroke threw him off his horse, onto his back. Not a muscle of his face altered, nor did a sigh betray the least sensation of pain. The blood flowed fast, but the attempt to stop it with my sash was useless from the size of the wound. Sir John assented to being removed in a blanket to the rear." End quote. Despite his almost shockingly calm demeanor, Moore was in very bad shape. His wound was so big and on such an awkward part of the body that there was no way to stop the bleeding. With the limits of early 19th century battlefield medicine, he would need a miracle to see another day. Sir John knew this. When the doctors arrived to attempt a treatment, he sent them away, saying, quote, "Go to the soldiers to whom you may be useful," end quote. He was still being carried towards the rear in a blanket by a group of soldiers from the Black Watch. Someone brought up a horse and cart to bring him back to La Coruña a bit faster, but the Highlanders refused to give him up, saying they could carry him much more comfortably. Moore agreed, and so the Highlanders carried him all the way back to headquarters. Apparently, some of them were crying. Fortunately for Moore, one of his best friends, Colonel Paul Anderson, was present at Army headquarters. The dying general was laid down on a mattress on the floor, and Anderson held his hand and spoke with him as he faded away. General Moore told his old friend, quote, "Anderson, you know I have always wished to die in this way," end quote. Despite the imminent loss of their commander, the day was going well for the British. Elvina had been retaken. Soult committed the last of his reserves to another attack on the village, but the British held them off. Further down the line, the French flanking maneuver was having trouble making any progress. They tried to deploy their cavalry, but the horsemen could not be effective on this rough ground, and were forced to fight dismounted. The British held them off, then brought forward three battalions from the reserve for a counterattack, which succeeded in pushing them back. The fighting along the British right flank had been extremely intense, but it was mercifully short. By about 6 in the evening, the French assault was over, although sporadic firing continued until darkness covered the battlefield. The Battle of La Coruña had only lasted about 4 hours. Back at British headquarters, General Moore was still clinging to life, clutching Colonel Anderson's hand. He said, quote, "I hope the people of England will be satisfied. I hope my country will do me justice. Anderson, you will see my friends as soon as you can. Tell them everything. Say to my mother," end quote. Anderson reports that Moore had to stop here because he became, in Anderson's words, excessively agitated. Clearly, it was very important to Moore that his subordinates not see him overcome with emotion. Sir John composed himself and continued, quote, "It is great satisfaction for me to know we have beaten the French. I fear I shall be long in dying. It is great uneasiness. It is great pain," end quote. The dying general looked to a staff officer, Captain James Stanhope, and said, quote, "Stanhope, remember me to your sister," end quote. Sir John then pulled Colonel Anderson's hand close to his chest, closed his eyes, and a few minutes later, he was dead. Moore's last words were quite surprising, maybe even a bit unseemly. Moore was known to be friendly with the woman in question, Lady Hester Stanhope, but he was not officially courting her. This declaration could easily be seen as proof of an improper romantic relationship. It might have caused a scandal had it been uttered under other circumstances. Moore played his cards close to the vest when it came to women and romance. He had always said he didn't believe serving officers should marry. Perhaps he had decided to make an exception for Lady Hester, or perhaps he planned to pursue her after he left active service. We'll never know. Whatever the nature of their relationship, it must have been profound. After the battle, Lady Hester was given one of the gloves Moore had been wearing that day, bloodstains and all. The glove was found among her personal belongings when she died 30 years later. It had cost him his life, but Moore had finally realized his ambition of winning a battlefield victory. Sources differ as to the cost. Estimates of French casualties range from 1,000 to 1,400, and estimates of British casualties range from 650 to 1,000. Comparatively few losses compared to many of the significant battles we've covered on this show. But if Soult's men had managed to make even a small, limited breakthrough, those numbers would have been much higher. General Moore was buried with no great fanfare. There was no time to organize a proper funeral service, or even to find a coffin. He was simply wrapped in his cloak and buried near the city walls, under a simple temporary marker. That evening, the remaining British leadership deliberated over what to do next. Some favored staying at La Coruña, Maybe Suult would attack again in the morning, and could be defeated again. A few of the bolder officers wanted to turn the tables and attack the French. But the army's new commander, General John Hope, decided to continue with Moore's original plan, and resumed the evacuation. The army worked through the night. When dawn broke on January 17th, they were still not finished. Once the French realized what was happening, they brought their artillery closer to the city, and were actually able to sink one of the transports. But they did not attempt another assault. The army was safe. In the wake of the evacuation, Marshal Soult's men romped through northwestern Spain with little resistance. The remaining coalition forces in the area, mostly poorly trained Spanish militia, surrendered very quickly. This represented a huge windfall for the French. There were a lot of supplies and equipment stored in Galicia. Enough food, clothing, weapons, ammunition, and gunpowder to completely resupply and re-equip Soult's corps, with more left over to send back to the depots. They were even able to capture over a dozen Spanish warships anchored at the nearby naval base of Ferrol, including 8 ships of the line. And so, La Coruña was a bit of a strange victory. The British had won, but the aftermath of the battle saw them limping home with only about 3/4 of their original force, ejected from the country they had been sent to liberate only a few months earlier. The French had lost, but in doing so had sent their enemies packing, seized control over a huge swath of territory, and gained a windfall in captured supplies and equipment. Back in Britain, news of the battle got a mixed reception. Many celebrated. There was a sense that this victory had redeemed the army's honor, which had been tarnished when they retreated from central Spain without a fight. Others considered the whole campaign a fiasco, and pointed out that the victory at La Coruña had achieved little more than staving off an even bigger catastrophe. A correspondent for the Times of London wrote, quote, "The fact must not be disguised that we have suffered a shameful disaster." End quote. In public, the government claimed the campaign as a success. The army had won a victory and slipped from Napoleon's grasp. But we know from their correspondence that many felt differently in private. British ambitions in Iberia had not been totally frustrated. There was no longer a British army active on the peninsula, but there were still British units present in Portugal and southern Spain, and there were plenty of good ports in these regions where the British might land more forces in the future. As for Sir John Moore, he was lionized by many as a hero, a great man who had sacrificed his life to save his army. Others criticized his leadership. After all, he had lost nearly 10,000 men and didn't really have much to show for it. Even in death, he couldn't help but be controversial. We've been focusing on Moore's retreat due to Napoleon's personal involvement, but throughout this period, there were important events occurring all over Spain. Among other things, the Patriots had launched a campaign to retake Madrid, and the city of Saragossa was under siege again. We will be telling those stories in the future, but for now, like Napoleon, we will be shifting our attention east. Bonaparte had new enemies to deal with, not only the Habsburgs. Back in Paris, there were men within his own government, who he had once looked upon as allies, who he now felt the need to confront. In the emperor's absence, the politicians had returned to some of their favorite pastimes from the revolutionary era. Scheming, intriguing, and forming cliques. The main offenders were 2 seasoned veterans of revolutionary politics, the powerful, malevolent Minister of Police, Joseph Fouché, and our old friend Talleyrand, the former foreign minister. As you might recall from episode 114, Talleyrand had recently embarked on a very dangerous course. He had begun secretly helping France's enemies. In light of this development, you would think he would be keeping his head down, trying to avoid Napoleon's scrutiny. In fact, he did the opposite, criticizing the emperor's policies at every opportunity to anyone who would listen. Perhaps this was just Talleyrand being his usual crafty self, zigging when you would expect him to zag. But I think his public criticism and private treachery were all part of the same agenda. He was trying to rally anyone he could around the idea of imposing limits on Bonaparte. As for Fouché, he had actually been in the emperor's bad books for quite some time, in large part due to his loud and increasingly public insistence that Napoleon divorce Josephine to marry a younger woman who could produce an heir. In fact, as we've discussed in episode 114, Napoleon had already come around to this idea in private, but he did not appreciate the fact that Fouché had been so pushy about this sensitive and personal matter. He especially did not like the fact that Fouché had broached the subject with Josephine, and had actually been quite confrontational and rude in doing so. Despite their somewhat similar backgrounds and approaches to politics, Talleyrand and Fouché had never liked each other. In fact, they were generally seen as rivals. However, they now found themselves in similar positions, both on the outs with the emperor. They also had similar views on the direction of the country. Both felt the preceding year had been a disaster. Both had opposed the intervention in Spain. And both felt subsequent events had vindicated their position. Talleyrand and Fouché had essentially come around to the same view. Napoleon was overreaching. His aggressive foreign policy since the Treaty of Tilsit had put France in danger. This jeopardized all the gains of the revolution, and it also represented personal danger for former revolutionaries like Talleyrand and Fouché, who would almost certainly suffer reprisals if the Bourbon dynasty was ever restored. With their views and interests finally aligned, the two devious politicians launched a very public friendship. The whole Paris social scene was shocked when the two former rivals suddenly started appearing as guests of honor at each other's parties, and warmly chatting at salons. Again, you have to ask yourself why they were doing this in public. If they were interested in plotting against the emperor, surely the best course of action would be to pretend they were still enemies, while working together in secret. I think this illustrates that, at least at this stage, they were more interested in putting pressure on Napoleon and forcing him to change course, rather than actually overthrowing him or seeing France defeated by the coalition. With that said, there was some scheming going on as well. As often happened when Napoleon left the capital to go on campaign, people began to whisper about the question of succession. As we've discussed many times in past episodes, Bonaparte was the key man in the French government. Practically every facet of the administration revolved around the emperor. What would happen to France if he was killed in action, or perhaps even worse, captured by the coalition? These were not unfounded concerns, but this type of talk is inherently dangerous in a dictatorship. A conversation about who might replace the leader should the worst happen can easily become a conversation about who should replace the leader. While the emperor was away in Spain, there were conversations on this topic at the very highest levels of the French government, including both Talleyrand and Fouché. It's very difficult to characterize these discussions. Perhaps some of the participants really were innocent and simply had legitimate concerns about what might happen if Napoleon was killed. Others might have been hoping to force a more drastic change in government, either to put pressure on Napoleon to change his policies, or even to actually launch a coup. Unfortunately for the plotters, there were no real obvious candidates to replace Napoleon. They needed someone with at least some sort of legitimate claim to the throne, which would mean a member of the Bonaparte family. Given the prejudices of the time, it would also have to be a man. The other Bonaparte brothers were all seen as unreliable. Joseph had proved incompetent during his brief time as regent. Lucien was still on the outs, not involved with the government, and not even living in France, And besides, his liberal politics and firebrand personality would have been a poor fit. Louis and Jerome Bonaparte were both young and inexperienced and seen as loose cannons. The most attractive candidate was Napoleon's stepson, Eugène de Beauharnais. By now, he was 28 years old and had grown into an intelligent, impressive young man. He had served as Napoleon's official representative to the Kingdom of Italy for several years, so he did have some of the relevant experience despite his youth. However, Napoleon had raised Eugène since childhood. Whatever Bonaparte's other flaws, he was a pretty good stepfather, and had taken a particular interest in mentoring his only stepson, who he believed was destined for great things. Anyone who knew Eugène knew he would rather die than turn against the only father he had ever known. There was only one person who had relevant experience, could plausibly claim to be a member of the Bonaparte family, and might entertain the idea of stabbing Napoleon in the back: the emperor's brother-in-law and self-described best friend, Joachim Murat. Remember, Murat had been deeply hurt when Napoleon rejected his request to become King of Spain, so much so that he had fallen into some kind of mental health crisis and begun to neglect his military duties. I'm sure these scheming politicians liked the idea of having a man like Murat leading the country. He was widely considered vain, unintelligent, and unsophisticated when it came to politics. The type of person who might easily be controlled and manipulated, unlike the independent, headstrong Bonaparte brothers. It's impossible to say how advanced these discussions became, or how serious they were. People involved in these types of conversations are generally careful to keep their intentions hidden. Perhaps we can refer to this as a nascent conspiracy, or perhaps it was just loose talk that emerged under the stress of wartime. But there was no question that two camps had emerged within the French ruling class, one that was still fully behind Bonaparte, and another that was growing disillusioned. The Austrian ambassador to France, Clemens von Metternich, observed these developments very closely. Here's how he described this dynamic. Quote, "Two parties exist in France, as much opposed to one another as the interests of Europe are to the individual ideas of the emperor. At the head of one of these parties is the emperor, with all the military men. He only desires to extend his influence by force. Napoleon sees nothing in France but himself, nothing in Europe or in the whole world but his family. The other party is composed of the great mass of the nation, an inert and unpliable mass. At the head of this mass are the eminent persons of state, Monsieur de Talleyrand, the Minister of Police, and all those who have fortunes to preserve." End quote. Of course, Metternich had a very negative view of Napoleon, which colors his whole analysis, but I don't think he was totally wrong here. At the beginning of his regime, the French ruling class had backed Napoleon because he seemed like the safe, stable choice. How long could that remain true if he kept jeopardizing France's national interests with risky foreign policy initiatives like the intervention in Spain? Napoleon was aware of these developments. Indeed, judging by their behavior, Talleyrand and Fouché wanted him to find out. Upon his return to the capital, the emperor decided to nip all this disloyal chatter in the bud by making an example of Talleyrand. On January 23rd, Bonaparte called a meeting at the Tuileries with all his ministers and other senior officials. All the leading civilian politicians of the empire would be there, including Talleyrand and Fouché. Napoleon started with a few general remarks. He accused the assembled dignitaries of being too independent and too public with their criticisms. Independence and free discussion were not exactly hallmarks of the Napoleonic regime. But Bonaparte wanted his government run like an army. He demanded obedience first and foremost, even from those at the very top. When these general remarks concluded, the emperor turned his attention to Talleyrand. Napoleon criticized his character, his opinions, his conduct, and just about everything else. Talleyrand refused to react. He remained quiet and still, leaning on a table by the fire with his eyes half closed, as if he was simply warming himself, taking no notice of the invective being hurled in his direction. This was theater. I've seen it speculated that Napoleon wrote this tirade in advance, so he wouldn't lose his train of thought or run out of things to say. But Talleyrand's lack of reaction seems to have gotten under the emperor's skin. As the diatribe continued, Napoleon started to get genuinely angry and began to go off script. There were complicated feelings between the two men. Talleyrand had once been something of a mentor to Napoleon. Now the emperor felt betrayed and abandoned. The tension between them had been building since Tilsit, over 18 months ago. The fact that Talleyrand didn't even seem to care how angry Napoleon was adding insult to injury. And so Bonaparte kept gaining steam, and the rant continued. 10 minutes, 20 minutes. Those feelings of resentment were boiling over. Obviously, no one was taking notes on this outburst, but one of those present later tried to remember some of what Napoleon had said. Quote, "You are a thief, a coward, a man without honor. You do not believe in God. You have all your life been a traitor to your duties. You have deceived and betrayed everyone. Nothing is sacred to you. You would sell your own father. I have loaded you down with gifts, but there is nothing that you would not undertake against me. What are you aiming at? What do you wish for? Do you dare say? You deserve to be smashed like a wine glass. I could do it, but I despise you too much to go to the trouble." End quote. There is some pretty strong stuff in that quotation, but it actually glosses over some of the nastiest things Napoleon said. Apparently, he also made fun of the fact that Talleyrand's wife was unfaithful, and he even mocked his disability. Talleyrand had been born with a club foot and walked with a limp. Bonaparte raged at Talleyrand for a full half hour before finally running out of steam. When he was finally finished, he stormed out of the room. Meeting adjourned. Napoleon had orchestrated this scene to humiliate Talleyrand in front of his peers, but it had backfired. The assembled dignitaries were aghast at his behavior. Gentlemen did not address other gentlemen in such terms, especially not in public, and certainly not in a formal government meeting. A man in Napoleon's position was not supposed to lose control of his emotions in front of his subordinates. One of the witnesses would later say that no one who saw this outburst would ever be able to think of it again without shuddering. Talleyrand never responded, at least not directly. As the dignitaries shuffled out of the room, he turned to one of the other attendees and said loudly, quote, "What a pity that such a great man should be so ill-bred." End quote. This was not a totally isolated incident. We've seen how Napoleon had lost patience with his generals over the setbacks in Spain. He had been snapping at his subordinates in the civilian government as well, although never quite as spectacularly as he had with Talleyrand. Napoleon had also begun suffering from recurring bouts of stomach pain from some unknown cause. Sometimes these episodes were bad enough that he was unable to sleep. Napoleon had always prided himself on his ability to sleep anywhere, anytime, so that is really saying something. Clearly, the stress was getting to him. Whether or not he was prepared to admit it in public, the intervention in Spain had been an unmitigated disaster. Now, with the Habsburgs mobilizing their armies, France was facing the possibility of a multi-front war. How different things had looked only a year and a half earlier, after the Treaty of Tilsit. No wonder the emperor was feeling the pressure. Around this time, Napoleon wrote to his brother Joseph, quote, "I have no hope as yet that Europe will be pacified this year. I have so little hope of it that I signed a decree yesterday to raise 100,000 men. Happiness? Ah, of course. There's little enough question of happiness these days." End quote. Yes, the French army would be expanding yet again. 100,000 more young Frenchmen called away from their jobs and families to put on the blue jacket. That nucleus of well-trained veterans who had delivered Napoleon so many victories would be even further diluted. Meanwhile, the Austrian army that was currently mobilizing for war was, in many ways, completely transformed. We've talked in past episodes about the tension within the Austrian military leadership. On one hand, there was the Young Guard, who wanted drastic reforms that would bring the Habsburg forces more in line with cutting-edge modern military theory. And, on the other, the Old Guard, who believed such radical experiments would only weaken the army further. The humiliating Austrian defeats of 1805 had more or less settled this argument. The Habsburg forces had performed so poorly that even the most cautious, tradition-bound officers were forced to admit things had to change. And besides, the army had suffered so many losses, it would have to undertake a painful rebuilding process anyway. Why not take the opportunity to introduce some changes? For years, the leading force for military reform within the Habsburg armies had been Emperor Francis's younger brother, Archduke Charles von Teschen. Thanks to his position at court and his reputation as a successful battlefield commander, the young Archduke had always been a powerful force within the army. But after the disasters of 1805, his influence had risen to new heights. In 1806, Charles was granted the title of Generalissimo, commander-in-chief of all Habsburg forces. He was also named President of the Council of War, roughly equivalent to Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the modern USA, or Chief of the Defense Staff in the United Kingdom. These moves made Charles the supreme authority over both the operations of the Habsburg military and its administration and organization. There were limits on his powers. He still had to answer to the emperor, and those reactionary old guard officers still had to be appeased. But there were no longer any official limits on his reform agenda, and so he pursued it energetically. For starters, the Austrians would be putting a lot more of their men into the field. The last time they had gone to war, back in 1805, they had managed to put just shy of 200,000 men into their field armies. 4 years later, there were over 300,000 troops mobilizing to invade the French Empire. This was made possible by reforms to the army and political administration, and by the huge resources the Habsburg government had put into recruiting and training new regiments. Estimates vary, but with so many French troops deployed in Spain, this probably gave the Austrians a slight numerical advantage in Central Europe. Of course, they would be badly outnumbered if France's Russian allies joined the war, but as you may remember from episode 114, Emperor Alexander of Russia had already provided the Austrians with secret assurances that he would not do so. Not only would the army be larger, it would be operating very differently. Since Austerlitz, Archduke Charles had written an entire book on military theory and organization, which had been adopted as the army's official doctrine. In past episodes, I've referred to the Austrian military as an old regime army, but as it mobilized for war in 1809, that was no longer really true. Probably most importantly, the Austrians had finally adopted a French-style system of organization. Gone were the days when regiments would be shifted back and forth between different brigades and divisions at a whim. The Habsburg field armies were now organized on roughly the same lines as the Grande Armée, each regiment permanently assigned to a specific brigade, each brigade to a specific division, divisions organized into corps, and corps into armies. Just like in the French military, each level of organization would have its own dedicated professional headquarters staff. This might not sound like much of an innovation, but this superior model of organization was a big reason the Habsburgs had been so consistently outclassed by the French. There was also an entirely new branch of the military, the Landwehr, a militia of part-time soldiers, similar to the state militias in the USA or the British Yeomanry. Like most militia troops of this period, their quality was very bad, but they could be used in emergencies or called up for second-line duties to free up regular troops for more important tasks. Austria's light infantry regiments had been equipped with new weapons, rifles, just like the British light infantry. This was part of a general renewed focus on marksmanship. All branches of service were issued ammunition for regular target practice, which had never been part of Habsburg military training in the past. In general, Austrian military training had become much more rigorous. A staff officer named Josef Radetzky von Raditz, who would later go down in history as one of the Empire's greatest soldiers, actually believed Archduke Charles had put too much emphasis on drill and training, which he believed made the Austrian troops less dynamic on the battlefield. Although even he probably would have admitted that too much training was an improvement over the old army, in which the lack of training had often led to poor performance. On paper, these all should have been encouraging developments for the Austrians. The Archduke's reforms had brought the Habsburg armies much closer to the ideal imagined in modern military theory. It seemed the Austrians were finally adapting to the military revolution that had taken place in the 1790s. Of course, there were still remnants of the old Habsburg army. Archduke Charles had been given wide latitude to carry out his reforms, but there were limits to his powers. Most importantly, there had been no purge of the officer corps. Just like in the last war, the average Habsburg general would be in his 60s. Most had come of age in an earlier era of warfare. Many had poor records in previous encounters with revolutionary French armies. Many of these aging generals had opposed the reform process until the need for change had become too acute to deny. How committed were they to the new way of doing things? Under the stresses of combat, without Archduke Charles looking over their shoulders, would they revert to old habits? More broadly, the Austrian army was preparing to go to war with a whole host of new doctrines and new systems, all of which were untested. The new Habsburg army looked great on paper, but war is the ultimate stress test. Lots of things that look great on paper fall apart when it comes time to put them into practice. On the political side, events in Spain had inspired some very grand dreams in Vienna. As Austrian policymakers finalized their plans for war, they imagined the people of Germany rising up to expel the French, just as the people of Spain had done. As I've mentioned in past episodes, any plan that relies on some distant mass of people spontaneously rising up to join it should be greeted with skepticism. That said, there was hostility to French rule in Germany, and those people were certainly aware of the example of Spain. Perhaps the Austrians were onto something. Of course, for the moment, this was all still secret. The Habsburg armies were, by now, almost fully mobilized and massing along the Empire's borders. But the Austrian government still publicly maintained its official position that it had no plans for aggression against France. The longer the preparations for war went on, the more absurd this position became. I always wonder if diplomats feel embarrassed to repeat such obvious lies, knowing they are not believed. Napoleon teased Ambassador Metternich, quote, "Well, this is something new at Vienna. What does it mean? Has a spider stung you? Who is threatening you? Whom are you aiming at? Do you want to set the world aflame again?" End quote. Indeed, the Austrians would set the world aflame again. Come spring, when the weather warmed up and the invasion finally began, the front lines would cut a huge swath right through the heart of Europe. The frontier between the French and Austrian empires ran in a huge arc, all the way from modern Ukraine, through Germany and the Czech Republic, all the way down to northern Italy. The fighting would take place on multiple fronts, across thousands of miles, and involve people from dozens of nations. We've talked in past episodes about the scale of warfare increasing over the course of the Napoleonic Wars. We are about to see the next stage in that escalation. Once again, France was facing war on multiple fronts, a situation that had nearly led to complete disaster in the wars of the First and Second Coalitions. Despite the recent French successes in Iberia, that theater of the war was nowhere near closed. With its recent reforms, the Austrian military was no longer a known quantity. The French would not be able to count on a clear advantage in quality over the Habsburgs, as they had in previous wars. The British were already preparing a new army to land in Iberia, and with their mastery over the seas, there was always the danger they could land elsewhere on the continent and open up yet another front. In Germany, many of France's recent conquests were restive, and many of her allies had questionable loyalties. Would Napoleon be able to hold on to these areas once the fighting broke out? Could he count on his dubious German allies if the going got tough? For the past 18 months, Napoleon had believed his alliance with Russia would keep the peace in Central Europe by deterring the Austrians. But as we saw at the Congress of Erfurt, that relationship had become very shaky, and it was becoming increasingly clear Bonaparte could not rely on Emperor Alexander. In fact, Napoleon didn't know it, but the Russians had already sold him out. After Tilsit, Napoleon's path to the final victory had looked relatively clear and simple. How much things can change in 18 months. No wonder the emperor was literally sick with worry. That's all for now. If you're signed up on Patreon, I'll be back to you in a few weeks with another bonus episode. Make sure to get in your questions in the comments of The Last Dispatch. As for the rest of you, I'll be back to you next month with the outbreak of the War of the Fifth Coalition. As always, thanks for listening.